Imagine deciding to build a completely complex AI-powered platform from scratch.
Ah.
And I'm talking about a platform with a working digital economy, live facial recognition, dynamic generative AI, and a global database.
Which is a massive undertaking.
Exactly. So how long should that take? Like a team of engineers working for 6 months?
A year. Oh, at least, yeah.
Well, what if I told you that one developer built all of that in a matter of days? And the absolute hardest part of the entire process wasn't writing thousands of lines of code. It was getting users to stop feeling guilty about inviting their friends.
I mean, it completely flips our traditional understanding of what makes tech startups difficult. We are so used to seeing, the polished, finished applications on our phones, and we just assume the magic is in the raw engineering. We rarely get to see the grease or the stripped gears or those late night psychological realizations that completely change the direction of a build.
But today, you and I are getting full access to the garage. So, welcome to the deep dive. We're looking at a developer's actual build diary, specifically days 12 through 19 of building an AI-powered platform called PanPanMao.
And it is a phenomenal window into modern software development because in just a single week, you watch this project morph from what the developer initially calls an interesting prototype into a full-fledged platform.
Yeah, with multiple product verticals and a working credit economy.
Exactly.
Our mission today is to track that evolution. We're going to explore the actual technical wizardry behind building an AI fortune teller that works right inside your phone's web browser.
Which is crazy to think about.
It really is. And we'll uncover a genuinely surprising realization the developer has at the end of this sprint about what the actual bottleneck in building software is today. Let me give you a hint. It is no longer the coding.
Which is a paradigm shift that changes how we need to think about technology businesses going forward. But to truly understand that shift, we have to look at how this platform was built, starting from the very beginning of the user journey.
Like how they actually get people in the door.
Yay!
Okay, let's unpack this. The credit economy and the referral system. If you want any platform to grow, you need your users inviting other users.
Naturally.
So the developer decides to build a referral system where everyone gets a unique code. You invite a friend, you get credits to use on the AI tools. Seems like the most straightforward thing in the world, right?
You would think so. But just capturing the simple fact that a user referred a friend requires a surprisingly robust three-layer architecture.
Right.
First, you have the URL parameter. Think about when you share a link with a friend and there's that long, messy string of characters at the
Oh,
end.
yeah, constantly.
Right. So when a friend clicks the referral link, the PanPanMao system captures a specific tag. It's ?ref equals ppm dash, followed by a unique string right there on the landing page.
Right. But people don't always click a link and sign up immediately.
Yeah.
Think about your own habits. You click a link a friend sends you, you read the homepage, maybe you get distracted.
You click around to see the pricing or read the about page.
Exactly. And by the time you actually hit sign up, you've navigated away from that original messy URL.
Precisely. So if the system only relied on that URL, the referrer would lose their credit. That's why the developer had to build a second layer, a local storage fallback.
Okay, break that down for us.
For you listening, imagine local storage as handing the user's web browser a tiny sticky note. The browser writes down that referral code and keeps it in its pocket while the user window shops around the site.
Well, that's clever.
It ensures the original referrer still gets paid, even if the actual signup happens 20 minutes and 5 page clicks later.
That makes total sense. Sticky note in the browser. But you still need to verify everything, which brings us to the third layer, server-side validation.
Right, the developer implemented a Supabase remote procedure call, or RPC, named claim underscore referral underscore bonus.
Hold on. For anyone not deep in database architecture, what is an RPC actually doing here?
Think of it like a bouncer at a very exclusive club. The sticky note in your browser is just you claiming you're on the guest list, but you can't be trusted.
Right.
So the browser hands that note to the server, the bouncer, who has the actual master list. That server-side function isn't just handing out credits blindly, it's checking for maximum referral limits.
Makes sense.
It's guarding against rain conditions, meaning it stops someone from using an automated script to tap the claim button 100 times a millisecond to trick the system into giving them infinite credits.
So the developer builds this absolute fortress of a referral system. The architecture is rock solid. But here's the crazy part. The architecture wasn't the problem.
No, not at all.
The hardest part was human psychology. Initially, The developer set up an asymmetric reward system. If I refer you, I get 10 credits and you get 3 just for joining.
Mathematically, that makes sense. You want to incentivize the person doing the marketing work for you.
It sounds logical on paper, but I love this detail from the diary. The developer looks at that 10-3 split and realizes it immediately feels like a multi-level marketing scheme.
Oh, totally.
If I send that to you, I'm basically forcing you to be my downline. Users actively gave feedback saying the system felt extractive. They literally felt guilty monetizing their friend.
What's fascinating here is how quickly human emotion dictates system architecture. The developer takes that psychological feedback and changes the code to a symmetric 5-5 split. Both people get exactly 5 credits.
No.
Now, mathematically, the developer is giving away fewer total credits per transaction, right? 10 instead of 13. You'd assume user engagement would drop because the reward is smaller, but the referral volume actually skyrocketed.
It's wild. You give the user less, but because the psychology feels fair, because it feels like you're giving your friend a shared gift rather than getting a kickback off their back, people actually use it more.
Exactly.
It just proves that incentive design and human emotion are so much harder to figure out than writing the raw code.
And sometimes the code you write to protect the system ends up actively hurting it because you didn't account for user behavior. Like in pull request 50.0, the developer implemented an overzealous fraud guard.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. The system was programmed to check a new user's usage log before granting them access, just to make sure they weren't a bot exploiting the free credits.
Oh, wait. If they are a brand new user, they don't have a usage log yet.
Yeah.
They haven't done anything.
Right?
That's like the bouncer at the club demanding to see your receipt for the drinks you haven't bought yet before he lets you in the door.
Precisely. It was rejecting perfectly valid, real human beings because the security system was checking for a scenario that was chronologically impossible at that exact stage of the user journey.
Ouch.
Yeah, the developer had to go back in and completely rewrite that logic.
Okay, so they fix the bouncer, they dial in the psychology of the referral system so people aren't feeling guilty.
Yeah.
But now you have to actually onboard these people.
Yes, which brings up pull request 41.
Right, because the developer realizes that the app has all these different verticals, Bazi, astrology, K-Line financial charts, and all of them require complex birth data. So they built a global onboarding modal that literally blocks users until they complete their profile.
Name, gender, birthday, exact birth time, birthplace.
Which is a massive amount of friction. Think about the last time you downloaded an app, and before you could even see what it did, it demanded your email, your birthday, and your location. You probably just closed it and deleted it.
Absolutely.
Right?
I'm out immediately.
So how did they get around that drop-off?
The developer was terrified of that. So they mitigated the friction by engineering a global quick fill button. In the Chinese interface, it translates to something like one click, import my birth data.
Nice.
Because they forced the user to do the hard work once during that initial onboarding blockade, every subsequent tool in the platform can instantly pull from that database. You never have to type your birth time again.
So you've solved the psychology of getting them in. You've removed the friction of the onboarding. Now you actually have to deliver the magical experience they showed up for.
The real core of the product.
Exactly. And this leads us directly into what the developer calls the most technically ambitious feature in the entire project. We're talking about Xiangshu, traditional Chinese palm and face reading.
This wasn't just a minor tweak. This was pull request number one. The developer essentially had to rip out the entire visual foundation of the app to build this.
Just massive amounts of code.
We are talking about nearly 7,000 lines of brand new code, touching 56 different files just to build out the core architecture. And the ambition here is staggering because the visual detection pipeline runs entirely client-side.
Meaning it runs right inside the user's web browser on their local device. There is no sending the photo to a cloud server, having a massive server farm analyze it, and sending the results back.
Exactly. No server round trip.
I have to pause and push back on this. Because running complex machine learning models live in a web browser sounds like an absolute disaster.
Oh, it usually is.
I mean, I've had web pages crash my browser just by loading too many video ads. If they are loading a massive AI vision model, how are they avoiding a 10-second frozen screen where the user just assumes the site is broken and leaves?
It's an incredible feat of optimization using a framework called MediaPipe. The developer knew that lag would kill the user experience. So first, they implemented a function called UseMediaPipeLoader. It's a lazy load for a 3-megabyte WebAssembly, or WASM binary.
Okay, for the non-engineers, what is a WASM binary doing?
Imagine WASM as a heavy-duty translator that allows your web browser to run incredibly complex software at the exact same lightning speed as an app installed directly on your phone's hard drive.
Okay.
But it's heavy. 3 megabytes is a lot to download instantly, so lazy loading means the app doesn't even try to load this heavy file until the precise moment the user actually asks to use the camera.
But that still means there's a delay when they click the camera button, right?
Yes, the first load takes a moment. But here's how they manage the user's psychology during that delay. As soon as the camera turns on, a totally different, ultra-lightweight model called BlazeFace kicks in instantly via a use face detector hook.
What does that do?
It runs at 60 frames per second. It doesn't do any deep analysis. It just draws a quick box around the user's face.
Ah, so it's managing expectations. It gives the user immediate fluid feedback. It's saying, hold still, I see you, I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
While the user's looking at that box, the heavy WASM file finishes loading in the background.
Exactly. It's an illusion of instant speed. And then, once the high-res photo is captured, the real heavy lifting begins. The use face landmarker hook runs a 478-point 3D mesh across the user's face.
Wow, 478 points.
Right. It is mathematically mapping out traditional physiognomy zones. The three sections, known as Santing, the five officials, or Wu Guan, and the 12 palaces, Sher Gongwei.
That's incredibly detailed.
And simultaneously, if it's a palm reading, a use hand landmarker hook maps a 21-point skeletal structure to identify the three major lines, Sandazhuxian, along with auxiliary lines and palm mounts.
Wait, stop there. 478 individual data points mapped on a face, analyzed locally on a mobile phone browser Safari tab. Again, I go back to the melting phone problem. The processor on a three-year-old smartphone should be catching fire, trying to render alive 478-point 3D mesh over a video feed.
You're entirely right, which is why the developer had to implement some incredibly clever mobile optimizations. For example, they put a strict 8-second timeout on the camera capture for mobile browsers, preventing the processor from hanging indefinitely and freezing the phone.
Smart.
Furthermore, think about those visual overlays, the green dots tracking your palm lines or the mesh moving with your facial features. Those are drawn on a transparent canvas layer over the live video. On mobile devices, the developer intentionally throttled this panda so it only updates every other frame.
That is brilliant. The human eye doesn't really notice the drop in frame rate on a tiny screen. It still perceives it as a live moving overlay, but the phone's processor is instantly getting a 50% break. It's only doing half the work to draw the graphics.
Precisely. But even with those tricks, they ran into a wall with hardware lies.
Hardware lies.
Yeah, in PolarQuest 35. The developer initially tried to use the phone's GPU, the graphics processor, to run the palm detection because GPUs are built for this kind of heavy visual math.
Right. Makes sense.
However, they discovered that certain mobile devices will actively lie to the browser. The phone will report, yes, I have WebGL support. I can use my graphics processor for this. But when the application actually tries to run the math, it silently fails.
So the user's just sitting there staring at a broken screen because their phone lied to the app.
Exactly. So the developer had to write a highly specific GPU to CPU fallback. The code essentially tests the GPU, detects the silent failure in milliseconds, catches it, and seamlessly retries the process using the phone's standard CPU instead. The user never knows it happened.
So they've solved the processor issues, they've solved the hardware lies, but then they hit a completely different wall. Geography.
Right, the network level hurdle. This was PR50. Initially, all these massive WASM files and AI models were hosted on a global content delivery network, a CDN, which usually makes things load faster.
Usually, yeah.
But the developer realizes that users in China couldn't reliably reach that specific global network due to firewall and routing issues. So the developer had to rip out the CDN architecture and localize all those heavy files directly to their own app-hosted assets.
It is an absolute gauntlet of problem solving. And mapping a 21-point hand skeleton and a 478-point face mesh in a browser without crashing the phone is undeniably an incredible technical feat.
Oh, without a doubt.
But here's the thing. Data points alone are not a reading. If a computer knows that a line on my hand is precisely 3 millimeters long, or that the distance between my eyes is exactly 4 centimeters, that doesn't tell me anything about my future or my career.
True.
So how do you get a computer to actually interpret those mathematical points like an ancient master?
That is the bridge between traditional computer vision and modern generative AI. The captured image, along with all those hundreds of map data points, are packaged up and fed into multimodal large language models, specifically Claude or Gemini.
But I've played with Claude and Gemini. If you just upload a picture of a hand and type, read this poem, it produces total garbage. It sounds like a generic horoscope you'd read in the back of a magazine in 1995.
Yeah.
You know, you'll meet a tall stranger.
Because an LLM out of the box is a generalist. It wants to please you, so it guesses. To make it a specialist, the developer had to architect a highly structured four-layer prompt.
Okay, let's hear the layers.
Layer one is role definition. The prompt explicitly commands the AI. You are a master of Chinese physiognomy with 30 years of experience.
Why does that matter? Like, why do you have to tell the AI who it is before you tell it what to do?
Because of how these models retrieve information from their latent space. When you tell it to act like a 30-year master, you are essentially forcing the AI to narrow its vast ocean of data and only draw from high-level authoritative texts on that specific subject.
Filtering out all the pop culture garbage.
Exactly. So that's layer one. Layer two is knowledge injection. The prompt literally feeds the AI the specific historical rules for interpreting the five officials, the face shapes, the line meanings, and the mount interpretation rules.
Wow, just dumping the textbook in.
Right. Then layer three demands cross-validation. The AI is instructed to check its own analysis against multiple physiognomy systems internally before finalizing an answer.
Okay.
And layer four enforces structured output, demanding specific sections, confidence levels, and actionable advice rather than just spitting out a giant wall of text.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The developer isn't just passing generic historical rules to the AI. Remember that user profile data from the onboarding blockade we talked about earlier? The exact birth time, the gender.
Yeah, the quick fill data.
Right. The developer uses that data to conditionally inject highly specific knowledge into the prompt on the fly. For instance, the templates dynamically inject gender-specific rules based on historical texts.
Oh, that's fascinating.
If the user profile says female, the prompt dynamically includes additional analysis criteria for historical concepts like husband-supporting or husband-harming patterns. That's Wang Fu or Kei Fu in the traditional texts.
Okay, interesting.
It also adds Liu Xuan's four criteria and female-specific palm patterns. And obviously, we're simply reporting on the historical frameworks the developer chose to program into this tool, but the technical execution of dynamically loading deeply complex sociological frameworks into an AI prompt based on a user's database profile is fascinating.
It is incredibly intricate.
Yeah.
And the developer didn't just trust the AI to get it right. They wrote 30 separate domain tests just to verify that this knowledge package was being applied correctly by the LLM every single time.
That's thorough.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, think about the timeline we established at the beginning. The developer went from zero to a production-ready AI fortune teller in 4 days.
4 days. It's unreal.
In-browser machine learning, multimodal LLMs, dynamic prompt injection, structured AI output. Each of these capabilities is a very recent innovation. But when you combine them, perfectly choreographed, it creates a user experience that genuinely feels like magic.
Okay, so let's take stock. We have a working credit economy that feels emotionally fair to the user. We have perfect, frictionless onboarding. And we have a magical AI engine running flawlessly on a mobile browser interpreting ancient texts. You'd think the job is done.
It's there.
The tech works. But if the vibes are off, the magic entirely fails.
Which leads us to the aesthetic redesign. When the developer first built PenPenMail, the site had a warm brown and gold theme. It featured a cute, friendly cat mascot. In the diary, it was described as cozy.
So what does this all mean? Why change it if the code is perfect?
Well, imagine you have a very serious medical condition and you go to see a top-tier, world-renowned specialist.
Okay.
You walk into their office, but the walls are painted neon pink, there's a clown making balloon animals in the corner, and the waiting room is a bouncy castle.
I'd probably walk right back out. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The medical equipment in the back room might be state-of-the-art, million-dollar technology, but that aesthetic completely destroys your trust in the results.
Yep.
You wouldn't trust a diagnosis from a guy making a balloon animal.
That is the exact psychological disconnect happening here. The developer realized that users were coming to this platform with very serious, heavy life questions. They were asking the AI about their career trajectories, their long-term health, their failing marriages.
Right, real stakes.
And the cozy, cartoonish aesthetic was actively undermining the profound gravity of the AI's output. It made the tool feel like a toy.
So the developer executes a massive visual pivot. The entire landing page is redesigned to a theme of dark luxury, deep infinite blacks, sharp gold accents, and that cute little cat mascot. It was redesigned to look like a mysterious ancient oracle.
The underlying product was exactly the same. The machine learning code didn't change a single line. The AI prompts were identical, but the positioning changed.
And what happened?
Well, the result was users started describing the platform and feedback as trustworthy and professional. By changing the colors and the mascot, it fundamentally changed how the truth of the AI was received by the human brain.
And they did all of this by day 19 of the build. They hit 7 distinct product verticals, a working economy, an optimized ML pipeline, and a complete brand redesign, generating around 700 commits in the code repository. Which brings us to the developer's ultimate epiphany.
Yes, the profound realization that the bottleneck of creation has flipped.
Right.
For the entire history of software, the absolute hardest part was the engineering. It was, can we make the database scale? Can we make the browser render this fast enough without melting the phone?
But looking at this diary, the developer realizes the engineering can now keep up with whatever I decide to imagine. The tools are so good, the frameworks like MediaPipe are so robust, and the generative AI coding assistants are so powerful that raw coding is no longer the speed limit.
The truly hard part now is product decisions. What exactly should we build next? How do we position it in the market? What aesthetic makes people trust it? What price do we charge so it feels valuable but not extractive? The human psychology is the new bottleneck.
It's an incredible journey to track. In just days 12 to 19, we watched Pam Pan Mao master the psychology of a referral economy, force massive 478-point machine learning models to run cleanly on mobile browsers, dynamically structure ancient physiognomy rules through 4-layer AI prompts, and completely redesign its visual identity to establish user trust.
It really highlights how the landscape of creation has fundamentally changed. This raises an important question, and it's something I'd love for you to think about after you finish listening today.
Laid it on us.
If AI tools and modern frameworks are making the actual coding and engineering the easiest part of building a business, will the most successful tech founders of tomorrow even be software engineers? Or will the tech industry soon be dominated by psychologists, sociologists, and designers? People who simply understand human trust, emotion, and incentives better than anyone else.
Because if the engine practically builds itself, the only thing that really matters is who is holding the steering wheel.